legislative commentary, or at least in the statutes themselves, there might be some help to the subcommittee on that. And I should clarify, in response to Representative Courtney's question, I don't know that you have to have that substantial likelihood language in here. I'm just indicating that it parallels the idea that you're trying to presume the joint trials. You could just leave it up to the discretion of the court and leave it in that language. In other words, shall be tried jointly unless in the court's discretion it finds there be prejudice to the defendant. I think by doing that, you're watering it down to the point where the courts may bend over backwards. In essence, you'll be back to a return to the status quo, because right now the presumption is in favor of separate trials. But there's no legal impediment to doing that if that would be more acceptable to the committee, rather than have that substantial likelihood of prejudice language.
Well, Mr. Barton, could you assist our staff? Could your office send over the federal statute? That would be some assistance. We don't have the U.S. Code in our library here. If you could send it over by tomorrow, I'd certainly appreciate it.
We'll do so, Mr. Chairman.
We'll circulate that also to the subcommittee. And I'd like to invite the subcommittee to review the California approach also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
May parallel federal, I don't know. I can't. Thank you.
Thank you.
This time we'll resume our public hearings of the three-bill group dealing with the insanity defense.
Mr. Chairman, would you like the members of the committee of the board to come?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Whoever you'd like to have with this one.
Of the committee, I would like to give some brief introductory remarks and also introduce the members of the board of the Psychiatric Security Review Board that are here, because they're the ones that deserve the credit for the system that works, because they're the ones making the decisions on behalf of the public. On my left is Walter Klopfer, who is the psychologist member of the board. On my right is the chairman, Judy Snyder. She is an attorney in Portland and has had extensive background as district attorney or assistant district attorney in Multnomah County. Lois Miller is our public member, and I think an important member of the board, giving a perspective that everybody finds helpful. And Richard Sly is our member from Yamhill County, who is a probation and parole officer. These are required statutory definition. Well, they're required by the statute that we have a psychiatrist, psychologist, probation and parole person, attorney, and public member. Our psychiatrist member is Dr. George Saslow, and he is not in town and couldn't be here today. Just very briefly, I've given you some testimony, and I would like to respond quickly as to the general responses the board has to the legislation. In responding to the legislation, I specifically talked mostly to House Bill 2075, which is the Interim Judiciary Committee bill, as well as to the amendments which have already been presented to you. I believe you have them hand engrossed in your bill, and we do support all of the amendments but feel they don't go far enough. Just very briefly, I would like to comment that the board feels very strongly in its work after people are found not responsible and put under the board's jurisdiction. We don't feel as strongly, we are not as concerned as to what the label people are given, whether it's guilty or not guilty, although we are supporting the change to have a guilty plea as opposed to a not responsible plea. We're much more concerned as a practical level what happens to those people, what kind of treatment they get, and the follow-up that occurs. I would like to also point out that we do believe Oregon has a unique system, and we're only the only state that has a board of this type. In other states, people that are committed to a hospital, it's then up to the hospital to decide or to the individual court to decide whether or not to release that person. Our feeling is that over the past 5 years, there's been a lot of adjusting and adapting that was made both by the mental health people and by the judicial system in working through a lot of the problems, because the uniqueness of the board is that we work basically independent of both the correction system and the mental health system, but we work very cooperatively with them. And for example, there was a lot of resistance, I think, initially by the mental health people who took on a new kind of corrections part in their treatment, in that we direct the patient to do certain things and we expect the community supervisor or social worker to report back to us, and we say exactly that they have to report to us if that patient is not doing what they've been told. In other words, they do some policing function, and I think initially there was a lot of adjusting that had to be made, and that now that has pretty much been worked out. I would like to also point out that we have been asked by a lot of different people about how the system is working in Oregon, and I don't know if any of you caught the NBC show, the white paper, last night that I think put us in a very positive light as not having all the answers, but having a system that does do the type of follow-up which is necessary for all people with mental problems. I also would like to point out that in my testimony, I'd like to pretty much end now, but in the testimony, I go through section by section as to some of the concerns that we have and with the amendments. Again, we do agree with the guilty plea, but we are very opposed to having the correction system involved if the person is discharged from our jurisdiction. We feel that would be very counterproductive to the sort of treatment that people get. The bill also, actually all of the bills also, deal with putting more restrictions on the board's ability, and in fact would restrict the board from being able to conditionally release people. We feel that the ability of the board to conditionally release people into the community is an essential part of the system, and that the community involved, getting the people slowly into the community with very strict supervision, is one of the reasons why it's working pretty well. And the revocations that we do, I described a specific case the last meeting we had here, the revocations that we do on a very quick basis of people that are starting to have problems well before there's any crime committed, for very small violations that indicate there might be any potential danger, that's the essential part of the system. We feel it's working very well. Unless later on you would like me to go through section by section, I think right now I'd prefer to give the different members to give you a very brief description from their perspective of their role on the board.
Good afternoon. My name is Judy Snyder, and I am the chairman of the board. I'm also the attorney member of the board. And my comments today are going to be brief, but they're going to address primarily the issues that I see being raised from an attorney's perspective, not specifically as a member of the board, but also as a member of the judicial system. From a practical point of view, I'd like to start with the basic assumption that our system in Oregon is working quite well. The board itself is only about 5 years old. Admittedly, we do not have a substantial history with which to provide perhaps the type of statistical data that we all might like to have in order to evaluate how well the system's working. But even in reviewing the testimony provided by the Attorney General's office and by the proponents of the pending legislation, I'm truly at a loss to see much in the way of a substantial criticism about the manner in which the board itself is functioning. My interpretation of what is going on today and the reason why these bills are being considered is as much because there is perhaps a public concern in general about the insanity defense as a result of the Hinckley trial and the issues surrounding that, and also the general nationwide attention that this issue has received, rather than a specific concern by members of the state of Oregon about how the Oregon system is working. Again, I suspect part of that is an educational process. I doubt that very many members of our community as of yet are fully aware of how unique the Oregon system is. But I would like to start with the basic proposition that the PSRB is working. And by working, I mean working in a manner so as to maximize and ensure the protection of the public. Now, in that context, I'd like to address just a couple of points that you're going to be considering with respect to the proposed legislation. One is the definition of the term mental disease or defect. One of the things that has been suggested, and I will add that the board supports, is excluding or at least defining whether or not personality disorders are part of the definition. Personality disorders would include everything from certain sex offenders like pedophiliac, child molester, to someone who might be suffering from a drug-induced syndrome, to a sociopath, any one of a number of various mental problems that fall into that category, but routinely do not give rise to the level of mental disease or defect as we traditionally might think of it as lawyers. However, we do have under our jurisdiction people who have been placed there primarily because of diagnoses of personality disorders. Now, when you're considering this legislation and perhaps considering excluding that personality disorders from the definition, although we support it as a board, as a whole, I think you must also take into consideration the potential retroactive effect of limiting that definition, because I can assure you that we will be getting motions from defense attorneys representing people before our board to discharge certain individuals because they no longer fit the definition of mental disease or defect. And again, I'm thinking we're going to be dealing with child molesters and other individuals who have been placed under our board because of a personality disorder that a judge found rose to the level of a mental disease or defect, and yet now might result in their being discharged. Secondly, in considering the question of the pending legislation, there's been a proposal to have the finding be addressed as one of guilty but mentally ill. Philosophically, again, we agree with that. We think that would be an assistance to us in our board hearings. There are two primary ways in which it would assist us. One is from a treatment point of view. If the individual who's before the board has to face the fact that he has been found guilty of the crime in question, I personally believe that it would be of assistance in working with these individuals and having them come to grips both with the mental illness and also the consequences of that mental illness. Secondly, it would assist us in that it would avoid, at the time of board hearings, having the patient's attorney attempt to relitigate the underlying facts which led to the person being placed under our jurisdiction. And although we have repeatedly told the patient's attorney that we are not about to address whether or not there are any appropriate self-defense issues which should have been raised, or whether or not the crime was overcharged based upon the circumstances, we do find with some regularity there is an attempt made to relitigate that. And this, again, I believe, promotes the misconception sometimes in the patient's mind that perhaps they didn't do anything wrong. They were found not guilty. Beyond that, the definition of mental illness as proposed by the Attorney General's bill, I propose, presents some substantial problems, just again from an attorney's point of view. It places an extremely high burden on an individual seeking to raise the mental disease or defect defense. Such a high burden that it almost appears to be seeking an absolute, which I doubt as a practitioner is one that really can be proven or ever established unless you had a psychologist or psychiatrist who was prepared to render an opinion which I would suggest as a routine matter would exceed the type of opinions that they're prepared to render. My concern is that if the definition of mental disease or defect is defined as proposed by the Attorney General, you're going to have very few cases in which a psychiatrist or psychologist will be able to give a definition or to evaluate a person within the context of that definition. What would the result of that be? In effect, you might end up with a substantial number of people being placed in the corrections system where they, in fact, may not get the treatment and care that they desperately need, that treatment that's available through the PSRB system and the mental health division that we work with. Secondly, you're facing the possibility that you're putting someone into the corrections system who is going to be perhaps run through the matrix system, run through the Oregon State Penitentiary, and back out on the streets again in a shorter period of time than they would have been had they been placed under the board's jurisdiction. Because if you've had an opportunity to review any of the statistics that have been put together by our former chairman, Jeffrey Rogers, and Dr. Joseph Bloom, I think you'll find that of the numbers of individuals who have been placed under our jurisdiction, and my figures indicate that 628 have been placed under our jurisdiction since the inception of the board, 313 have been discharged, and more than 100 of those have been discharged because the time ran out under which we could keep them. In other words, approximately 1/6 of the cases resulted in discharge, not because we wanted to let them out early, not because we found that they were no longer dangerous or no longer mentally ill, but because their time had expired, and that time is, of course, the maximum amount of time that they could have been sentenced. Gentlemen, this far exceeds anything that you're going to receive under the correction system in terms of treatment and incarceration or institutionalization for these individuals. Another thing you should be looking at when you're deciding whether or not to change the definition of mental disease or defect is that, again, according to the statistics compiled by Jeff Rogers and Dr. Joe Bloom, 26% of the people placed under our jurisdiction arrive there by reason of stipulation, where the prosecution defense agree, 86% where there has been an agreement on the behalf of the attorneys involved, which has been accepted by the judge, that the individual is mentally ill. Only 14% of all of the cases go to trial, and only 4% of the total cases are tried to a jury. In summary, I think that reflects the general acceptance by the corrections, by the criminal justice system, with the manner in which the insanity defense is working in the state of Oregon. One final statistic that I think is interesting is that overall, the numbers of individuals who are raising the insanity defense has decreased in Oregon over the 5 years that the PSRB has been in existence. I would offer the suggestion, although I don't have the statistical data to support it, that that decrease has been because the PSRB has been adopting a tough position on crime, and defense attorneys and their clients are being more cautious in raising that defense to make certain that they are not putting the client in a position where, in fact, he may be institutionalized for a longer period of time than if he had been placed under the correction system. I ended up talking longer than I intended to, and I had hoped that there would be some questions that might interrupt me. That's just kind of the attorney's perspective of what I think are the high points proposed by the legislation, the major concerns that I have. If there aren't any questions, I'd prefer to defer to one of the other members of the board.
I think what I'd like to do is see if I could hold questions until we hear from everyone, and then we can take them as a group.
I'm Walt Clopper, and I'm a psychologist member of the board. In my other life, I'm a professor of psychology at Oregon State University. The other mental health professional on the board is Dr. George Zaslav, who is the former chairman of the psychiatry department at the University of Oregon Health Sciences. I'm going to make a few remarks which represent our views, as Dr. Zaslav. The first point I'd like to make is that mental disease and defect, as it's defined in our statute, does result in violent crime. And I'd like to give some examples of how that works. First of all, a lot has been said about sexual deviancy and sexual offenses, and one way in which sexual offenses come under our jurisdiction is that the individual in question is mentally retarded, because the term mental defect and mental disease and defect is often taken to mean mentally retarded. These people are not sufficiently intelligent to learn or socially skilled things in their own family, and oftentimes have to spend a good deal of time building a state training center in order to learn more adaptive ways of behavior. These people really are dangerous. I don't think I can convince you. The second example are people who have a religious zeal, a sort of peculiar kind of religion and a sense of special mission, which makes them feel justified in persecuting members of other races or other genders. And until they are relieved of their peculiar ideas, they continue to be in danger because of their peculiar thinking. The third example are people who generally feel persecuted, feel that other people are their enemies when they're just strangers and don't know them at all. They're likely to harm people that they come across who they don't even know because of their misinterpretation of reality. Still, the fourth example are people who are self-destructive, who sometimes endanger other people as they go on their way trying to kill themselves, for instance, in a vehicle or by setting fires. I think that people who are so self-destructive they don't care who they destroy along with them obviously represent a danger to the community at large. That's my first point. My second point is that the ethics of the review board are perfectly consistent with the ethics of my professional psychology, and that the first consideration is the protection of society as a whole. And dealing with the individual client, patient, or offender, whatever we choose to call them, is a distinct sector. Dr. Zaslow and I believe that society is better served by psychiatrically disturbed persons who are dangerous to others being treated forensic unit of the Oregon State Hospital than by being handled in the Corrections Division for several reasons. In the first place, in the hospital, patients who are dangerous to others because of their mental disease and defect are relieved of their delusional thinking and their suicidal depression by appropriate medication, which has very dramatic results. And as long as they take that medication, there's a distinct lesson. Also, the patients that we have, all of them have, in addition to their mental disease or defect, also they have antisocial tendencies. I think that's well known by the staff of the hospital. Some of them have very pronounced antisocial tendencies, others they're less pronounced, but they all have them. And behavior, which is dangerous to others, is retrained by behavioral means by experts who are on the staff of the hospital over a long period of time in a very careful system in which people work themselves up a privilege ladder in which they have peer pressure from other patients, and particularly as far as the board is concerned, which they have support for their progress and non-support for their non-progress from members of the board. One of the things I've learned in the 2.5 years that I've served on this board is that the board as a board is very meaningful to the patients who are under our jurisdiction. They see us as having power over them as to what happens to them when they don't leave and under what conditions. And they listen to what we have to say. Even when we don't make any change in status, we tell people what they're doing right and what they're not. Snyder is very good at encouraging people when they're making progress, taking more responsibility, behaving better. So my conclusion is that if the purpose of the law is to protect society more adequately from dangerous persons, then I think it's doing its job. I think generally we are a conservative board. I think that if we're on the spot, we err on the side of caution, not letting people go free, and we think they might possibly represent the danger to others. And it's very often pointed out, as Snyder has already indicated, that many people are more protected from society and more restricted under this system that they would go in directions to go through the building. So I believe, as I pointed out, that it makes sense for there to be such a law. People really do commit violent crimes because of mental disease defect. It's not just a put on. Some people have to leave. And I think that people who legitimately are that way are better treated, better rendered, less dangerous through this system than through any other.
Lewis Miller, the public member of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I think the board is unique in that it has not only the disciplines involved, the legal and the mental health disciplines, and the corrections discipline, but a person from the public sector. Certainly, we want to commend you for your concern for public safety and the District Attorneys Association, the Attorney General, and the Interim Judiciary Committee, because the discussions that you have created around this state with the legislation that is before you has, in its own way, helped to increase the education of our citizenry, as well as make us more responsible and more visible It is a scary proposition to realize that you are sitting on a board where you will be responsible for the actions of those people that you release into the community. So it is not a lightly taken by any member of this board. I know that there have been some concerns about people being released, or excessive numbers, as some say, who are not suitable. But the question is, what is suitable? And it's a very fine line to decide sometimes whether the person is mentally ill. Certainly nobody is completely mentally ill or completely well. And I'd like to remind you that we have to have an element of trust in our courts and police system, that perhaps that person was not acting as well at the time as they committed the crime as they might be when they come before us after they've been medicated and in a supervised structural situation. Conditions do change, and so we do have that element of trust in the courts and the police that they acted appropriately at the time and that these people do need some assistance. I also want to mention that you know that just the basic changes in body systems can cause confusion and incoherence. And I think if you note when people climb Mount Everest or some other place and they're deprived of oxygen or they become hypothermic, just a basic change in body temperature causes them to be, in essence, what we might call mentally ill under any other situation. Same thing is true with changes in blood sugar. But those people, when they are medicated and in a situation with particularly with the blood sugar system, if they have insulin, they can maintain and be perfectly normal. One of the problems that we have with many of our clients is that when they are quite well medicated or when they are aware of their problems and stay within the bounds of their physical capabilities with structure and supervision and eating appropriately and not consuming some kinds of illicit drugs or alcohol, that causes their confusion, they act very appropriately, and so they are not completely mentally ill or completely well. It's interesting that we release our patients, we call them clients, into the community on a conditional release, and in essence that's what we do with teenagers or anybody else in a parental situation. You like to identify what you expect of them, and you put it in writing, and then you expect them to hold to that because it's in their best interest. And just last week we had an illustration of a person that was released by the court on a conditional release. And I know that that particular amendment came to this bill in about 1979 that allowed the judges to release into the community to those resources for which they are particularly familiar, persons that don't need to be incarcerated in the state hospital, but they do need to be under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And this happened to be an 80-plus individual who had committed a murder but could be kept in the community in that kind of a setting that provided the 24-hour supervision, the monitored medication, and all of those things that would keep that person from recommitting. We do review those kinds of court-released people, and under 2075, there was an effort to not allow the courts to do the conditional release, and I would urge that still be an appropriate use for the conditional release. In our contracting or conditional release, we are explicit about our expectations and the responsibility of the individual to meet those expectations. And Ms. Snyder pointed out to you that if they don't, we don't wait until they recommit, but we ask that they come back and try again. And that's no different than any other segment of parenting that I know of. And when people ask what we do, I say I feel like sometimes it's a giant parenting job. It gives the person a long-term hold on these people, gives the person some criteria to meet, gives an impetus for change, and assists them in finding those coping skills that will keep them safe in our society if they are out. I think probably sometimes the issue is time and money, and I think that given time, you will find that the interdisciplinary action, being able to work with the courts, the mental health and the correction system, that this will, in fact, prove to be probably the least economical, or the most economical of any of the systems that we've tried. It certainly does increase our cross-disciplinary action. And I think we should definitely point out that our single biggest problem is the housing in communities when these people are out, and the fear that people have that they will recommit. And I think this system of conditionally releasing is probably one of the best efforts that you can make in keeping people free from mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Richard Sly. I'm an adult parole and probation officer. I work in McMinnville. And I would join my colleagues and Felicia in explaining that I think the board is doing a very adequate job in the concept of protecting the community from folks that come before us. I'd like to point out that in Yamhill County, we have a community corrections program. And why do I mention that? I mention that because I think the PSRB, in placing people on conditional release, as Lois has mentioned, finds itself with a very cost-effective means of placing people in the community.
And currently, they're less than 800. There's been an increasing focus in the psychiatric literature on the association of mental illness and criminal behavior, and we have found that many of the people with serious mental disorders have an increased rate of criminal-type behavior, and this is most likely due to the circumstances, to their living circumstances. What this means is that generally we found that when civil commitment rates go down, criminal confinements go up. So you're dealing with a dynamic balance between the civil side and the criminal side, and you're also dealing with a dynamic balance between the civil side and the prisons. And I think you have to think of these three areas as management areas of certain types of individuals with certain types of problems. And it seems to be most true that the mental health system can manage the mentally ill better, a lot better, than the criminal justice system can or the correction system. Now, the Psychiatric Security Review Board is a board that has managed a very, very seriously disturbed population. I don't think too many people will dispute the fact that it has worked well and has become a model both in the federal system and for other states, and that there are a number of states that are now looking to create the kind of system that we have here. My own personal view of the current status of what we need to do is that we need to do some fine-tuning at most, and radical changes would be, from my point of view, the least desirable. The PSRB system allows for the segregation of a very seriously disturbed population, both from the jails, and provides a very high degree of community security. I want to address a couple of things in relation to the bills. I really didn't know how to prepare for this part of the testimony because I understand there's a lot of amending going on and giving and taking as to what's going to actually be looked at. So I'm going to... I'm correct?
Good. A lot of things going on.
So I'm going to just talk about the things that I don't know if they're going on or not, and hopefully they'll be of some use to you. The first thing that I would take exception to in House Bill 2075 is the shift of the finding of not responsible, or basically shifting the insanity defense from the trial phase to the sentencing phase of the hearing. And the reason I say this is that I believe that sentencing is a much more open process. Lots of things go on in sentencing. Lots of information is allowed to be brought into sentencing that doesn't come into the trial. Sentencing has different goals than the trial. In sentencing, there is a rehabilitative goal, which is part of the Oregon Constitution. If you move the decision to the sentencing part of the trial, I would predict that you're going to have an inordinate increase in the number of people sent to the state hospital as opposed to sent to the prisons. There is no fine line between a criminal and a mentally ill person. There are some people who believe all criminals are mentally ill. I'm not advocating that, but there are some people who believe that. And as you have this thing played out in every circuit court in this state, I think many, many judges and many attorneys who care about helping this individual will move that person out of the criminal, out of the correction system and into the mental health system. And I think you run a very, very substantial danger of overwhelming this tiny resource. You saw the whole resource before you a few minutes ago. That's it. That's the board. I think you can overwhelm the board, and I think you can overwhelm the hospital. I think you can break down the treatment categories that they have established where they're effective in. I think you can, that people will make some of those decisions based on helping the individual, relieving prison overcrowding, providing treatment. I think it's a very dangerous move to do that because of these things that I've cited. I think the trial phase itself is much more technical. I view the insanity defense as a technical issue, and people have tried to work out over the years what these phrases mean, and I think there is some agreement about what the insanity defense actually means, and I think that it's much more contested, even though we hear that and we know that it's not fought out in the courtroom. I think the lawyers, the defense attorneys, and the prosecutors are very careful about who comes to an insanity defense. I think enough said on that. The issue of designated offenses and transferring those individuals to corrections, I think that's an intellectually untenable position. I think if you transferred people to corrections, you would be setting up two PSRBs. The one that said that this person is in remission and maybe is cured and should go to the prison, and the one that said this person's in remission but still is sick, because the statute says if you're in remission, you're still sick, and this person can go on conditional release. And I think it's intellectually untenable. It doesn't make sense. If you want to move people to the correction system, you don't need a PSRB, from my point of view. Let them go to the hospital, get their mental illness treated, and go to the prison. There are many states that work on interinstitutional transfers. I think you can do that. I don't think you need a PSRB to decide when this person is cured and should go to prison, as opposed to when this person isn't cured and can go on conditional release. If they keep their position intellectually consistent, then they'll never discharge anybody. They'll never be able to move anybody, because a mental illness in remission is still a mental illness, and we'll keep building new wards for Dr. Trelevin at a very rapid rate, because he won't be able to discharge anybody. Third point, cutting the insanity defense in half, the standard in half, removing conforming and keeping in appreciating. The American Psychiatric Association is advocating doing this. From my point of view and in my practical experience, I just don't understand it. I don't think we have enough information to make that decision at this point in time. And if we're really interested in making this decision on a reasonable and rational basis, I would recommend that you ask the judges that you amend the statute and make the judges make a finding for the next biennium as to whether this person is not responsible because they're unable to appreciate, and this person is not responsible because they're unable to conform, or both. And at the end of 2 years, we'll be able to tell you something about the people who are in either category. Right now, I think it's a crapshoot. And I think by just cutting it in half, it's done just because that seems like that's a nice thing to do. I don't think it means anything in my practical experience in terms of mentally ill people. So I think that it may be a wise thing to do, but I think there's nothing wrong with studying it for another biennium, since we only have 85 people per year, and we could come back here 2 years from now, as we probably will anyway, and tell you of the 160 people that went to PSRB, this many came because they weren't able to appreciate, and this many because they couldn't conform, and then let's look at whether we should do that or not. The Attorney General's bill, I have the most trouble with. I think you need to be unconscious to pass the test for the Attorney General's bill. I know of no living individual that would meet that test who is either alive or conscious. And most of the people who we see are both. So I think what the Attorney General's bill accomplishes, and I think it's quite clever, is to eliminate the insanity defense without eliminating it, which is a very good way to do it because he's set up the appeals process. Argan didn't eliminate the insanity defense. We just changed the standard a little bit. Doesn't matter that nobody qualifies, but we still have one of those things because maybe out there there's some person that qualifies. And I think if you want to eliminate the insanity defense, I think you should do it up front and see what happens. Let's let the appeals court see if you're right in doing it. But I think that's the major intent of that bill. And the Attorney General also does not seem to be disturbed about sending mentally ill people who are severely mentally ill to the Oregon State Penitentiary or the OC State Correctional Institute. I think that the administrators of those institutions should be down here telling you that they're not very comfortable in receiving them, aside from the fact that they have no beds anyway. I think that they would have a great deal of difficulty with this population. Now, Jeff and I have some indication that in some states where they have fewer insanity defenses than we have here, and people do go to prison, that these persons become severe management problems within the prison system. And the prison system has enough management problems right now. If you've ever visited that place, you'd know that to be true. So I would think that we should be vitally concerned about who we send to prison and who we send to the hospital, and would be a lot less comfortable with just cavalierly sending these people to prison. The issue of defining mental disease or defect for the purposes of the insanity defense statute, I believe that when we testified 2 years ago, we recommended this as one possible way to go. We believe that the insanity defense was initially developed for and should be for people with very, very serious mental disorders. We believe that, as we said earlier, that greater than 75% of the people in our system have serious mental disorders. We think that you could eliminate some of what are labeled perhaps inappropriate insanity defenses, and an inappropriate insanity defense means to me that they don't meet the test, by defining mental disease or defect. And I think you could define that by looking at psychosis, mental retardation, organic brain syndrome, and excluding personality disorders. I think there are some problems with that because the diagnoses that we are telling you from our studies come from the state hospital. That doesn't mean that in the trial somebody didn't say they were psychotic or one of those other things. But I think if we define that, people might look at it a little more carefully, and the trial process might be a little more in tune with trying to exclude certain types of individuals. In summary, I think it's the position of, it's my position and the position of the Oregon Psychiatric Association that we basically have a very functional system, and we have few enough functional systems that we probably should leave this one alone as much as possible. We believe that the PSRB and the state hospital serve a very disturbed population and a population that wouldn't be handled with ease at the state penitentiary. There are financial implications involved in some of these changes, which I hope you're considering. And there certainly are implications for the treatment of these people, which I think we should also pay attention to. Now, a little later today, Mr. Rogers will have some comments that we've discussed in line with some of these suggestions. And that about does it.
Any questions for Dr. Broome?
The lacking substantial capacity versus conforming conduct, in your practice as a psychiatrist, do you see any significance to a distinction of a person's conduct on one side or the other of that definition?
I've been trying to think through it since I viewed this thing, and I've looked back on some cases, and I can't really say that. I think we need to look at it more closely, and I certainly, I never say that people with personality disorders have an insanity defense, so I don't get into that thing in terms of conformity, and I think one of the issues with the conformity in terms of how people approach the insanity defense is what type of diagnostic framework they're using for the courts. And I believe in a descriptive framework where you're trying to describe how disordered is this individual descriptively, not does this person have underlying psychological problems and issues of psychological determinism. I don't believe that has a place in the courtroom. So I really think that in my cases, that they're only real serious cases that I think should get into the system to begin with, and I can't honestly make that separation, and I think we really need to study it a little bit more.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Dr.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Swain. Yes, I'm Mike Fine. Yes. The two of you would like to be together as well.
For the record, my name is Michael Swaim. I am an attorney in the private practice of law in the city of Salem. I've been practicing approximately 11 years. I practice probably equally in the civil and criminal domains. I am representing not only myself here this afternoon, but also the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Let me start with saying that, first of all, we did distribute before the previous hearing a copy of the brief that we prepared. If you do not have it, cannot put your hand on it, want another copy, we do have a couple extras available and we will give them to you. Second of all, let me say that it is a proper function that you find yourself in today. The public mood has been such that they've questioned the validity of the insanity defense. The public has raised the issue before you, and as elected representatives of the public, I think it's a proper thing for you to get involved in doing. That is not to say that we feel that there ought to be modifications to the present insanity defense statute here in the state of Oregon, ORS 161.295, because we do not. But that doesn't say that we shouldn't investigate the possibilities before we urge you to come to that conclusion. We'd start, first of all, with the proposition we ought to know what we have before we decide what it is we want to change it into. And I think that we should be informed of the fact that the present test is the consequence of 9 concerted years of investigation, study, research, and debate by some of the best legal, philosophical, and medical minds in the country. Not only did these people, and that's the American Law Institute, not only did these people consider every statement of defense in every state in the United States, but all the federal jurisdictions, Great Britain, and of course the Model Penal Code came out in 1962. At that time there was a British Commonwealth, New Zealand, India, Pakistan, Australia. They considered each and every test in each of these Commonwealth nations in every country in Western Europe before they came to the formulation which they have presented to us in 1962 and which the state legislature adopted in the early 70s. Secondly, the present statute is a compromise of extremes existed in the United States and in many parts of the world at the time of the adoption of the Model Penal Code. The stream on one hand being McNaughton right or wrong test, and on the other hand the Durham product test that was originated by David Bazelon, Circuit Court of Appeals for the U.S. Federal Court in the D.C. Circuit. So where do we get the impetus for change? We see John Hinckley's trial coming up, the man is acquitted, and we find the outcry arising. We find also there's a set of myths that perhaps have been once again rekindled in the public mind that provides an impetus for ourselves to look again at what has happened. One of those myths that we often hear is that the insanity defense is too frequently used and too often successful. Unfortunately, we find the Attorney General citing and reciting ad nauseum The statistic that the state of New York finds itself in a situation in which they see the defense of mental disease or defect 1/9 the number of times that we find in Oregon. In other words, in Oregon, it's used 9 times more than in New York. They don't stop to tell you that in New York, as Mr. Rogers has indicated, selects these people out of the system before they get to trial. They never become a trial statistic. That is the reason. Interestingly enough, I haven't researched it myself, but I was informed today, and it's my recollection, it's true, New York has the same or a very similar statute. We don't hear the Attorney General saying, substitute in the New York statute, because we'd have the same statute. It's a matter of process, not a matter of the formulation of the test. We hear that the success is 1 in 1,000 here in the state of Oregon, not a very large statistical trend. We hear the myth that the defense confuses jurors, but we find that in 1979, the experience before the PSRB was only 3% of the commitments were by jury trial. It's 4% as of the most recent survey. If jurors are being confused, it's not to the benefit of the defendants. We submit that they're being confused to the benefit of the prosecution, or perhaps they're not being confused at all, and they're simply adjudicating the responsibilities that they have before them and deciding which side they should side with. We find that Newsweek, May 24, 1982, did a survey nationally, find the same statistics, seldom used, seldom frequent, or seldom succeeding. Jack Ruby, Sirhan Sirhan, John Wayne Gacy, all people that raised the defense failed. Sarah Jane Moore, the attempted assassin of President Ford, failed. Patty Hearst. Ask people on the street what happened in those trials, and I'm told that a surprising number of people will tell you that these people got off on an insanity defense, popularly misunderstood. Charles Manson, Mark David Chapman, the assassin of John Lennon, and David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, didn't even raise the defense, all certifiably crazy kind of people. Interestingly enough, John Rappaport, physician, psychiatrist, prosecution expert witness in the John Hinckley trial, reports to us in the July 9, 1982 issue of the American Medical News that he doesn't think the defense there should be modified or abolished, but we ought to try to understand it. He says a problem of understanding. He thinks the jurors inappropriately came to the conclusion that they did. He felt that John Hinckley was guilty and that the prosecution had proved it beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty. But the jurors did not agree with him, and he felt they were wrong in that failure to agree. It points up another difference in our system. In that particular jurisdiction, the prosecution has the burden of proving sanity beyond a reasonable doubt. Here in Oregon, it's a tougher burden for defense lawyers such as myself. We must prove insanity and prove that by a preponderance of the evidence. Another myth that we hear is that psychiatry is uniquely prone to contradiction. We have a battle of experts. I submit to you that the people that we hear saying this are career prosecution types that have not been out and tried personal injury cases, have not been out and tried product liability cases, because in each and every instance of every important case in these other domains, we have a battle of experts. In the personal injury case, we have an orthopedist who says it's a permanent injury and it's resulted in a certain amount of permanent disability. We have another equally qualified orthopedist who said either there wasn't a permanent injury or it didn't result in this kind of permanent disability. As long as you're going to have the kind of system that we do have, and I think it's the best available that we know of in terms of adjudicating facts, you're going to have expert witnesses, and when you have expert witnesses, you're going to have a difference of opinion. That's why we have jurors there to adjudicate which opinion they're going to side with. It's not unique to psychiatry. They get the most heat because the doctor who says, I find this man has a permanent injury to his leg and he's going to be crippled the rest of his life, doesn't get the heat if the guy goes out and robs the Circle K market down the street after perhaps he's not successful in his PI suit. But in any case, the psychiatrists do catch the heat because the person they say that either was or was not mentally disturbed goes out and commits another crime, and then the physician, the psychiatrist, psychologist who said that he was no longer suffering from mental disease or defect is the one they point the finger at. And it's a very uncomfortable position, I suspect, and one that I certainly wouldn't relish. But the psychiatry is not unique in terms of contradictory statements of experts, engineers, structural engineers. You can find it all the way down the line. There's the myth that if you're successful, you're subject to immediate release, or if not, you're submitted or subjected to a brief confinement in conventional hospital. As Dr. John Rappaport of the Hinckley trial said, if anybody believes that going to a secure mental hospital is not punitive, that shows to him the person has not been acquainted with what a secure mental hospital is all about. There certainly is a punitive aspect to being committed to a secure ward. If nothing else, it limits your freedom. The fact of the matter is, here in Oregon, people do not spend just a brief amount of time. I can tell you from personal experience that the individuals that I have come into contact with before the PSRB spend substantially more time under the control of the PSRB and secured control than do people that go to the criminal corrections division side of the process. People that it would be available for immediate probation or parole after 6 to 10 or 12 months spend years under the control of the PSRB, and much of it within the security confines of their particular facility. So that is also a myth. And the final myth, I think, is that the previously committed people are prone to recidivism. And I think some of the statistics mentioned here today and some that you have before you that have not been mentioned indicate that the track record of the PSRB is substantially better than the track record of Corrections Division. Now, this is not meant to be a commentary on the ability or inability of corrections to do the job that it sets out to do. It's perhaps the nature of the clientele in conjunction with the ability of the PSRB to monitor the progress of these individuals because they have the resources and the personnel and the expertise to do that. Fact of the matter is, when you get to bottom line, only 10% of the people that have been through the PSRB system are out committing new crimes, where you have anywhere between 35% and 80% of the people have been through corrections, depending upon how it's reported, back committing new crimes. So if the bottom line is to reduce the amount of criminal activity, you certainly don't want to engender a system which diverts more people into corrections. We've got to understand, I think, what it is that we're about in the process here, because what looks like maybe an investigation into doing some fine-tuning is really posed in terms of the statutes that I'll refer to in a minute, the proposals, the bills before you, to critically attack the very heart and fiber of the criminal justice system. When you get right down to it, the criminal justice system is a system of morality. We are making moral decisions about what society and persons within that society should or should not do. And if I can refer to the issue of perhaps changing the nature of the plea from guilty, or excuse me, not responsible, to guilty but not responsible, I have to say to you that that's a contradiction in terms. The whole course of Anglo jurisprudence is that a person is not guilty unless they have committed the act without the benefit of defense. For an example, a person commits a homicide in self-defense, positing the fact that he has a good self-defense. We do not say that that person is guilty of murder but not responsible for murder. That's the same situation you're being asked to contemplate in terms of saying it respects a person who is not responsible because of mental disease or defect, find him guilty, which assumes moral culpability, which assumes the absence of defense, but then to say they're not responsible for that guilt. The basis of the criminal law as historically developed is that we attempt to punish those persons who are able to choose between right and wrong and freely choose to do the wrong. The proposals before you in terms of these three bills strike at that very concept when they take away from the insanity defense the volitional aspect of that. Your present statute has both a cognitive knowledge perception aspect to it, as well as a volitional aspect. And it makes little difference between not knowing what one is doing, let's say in terms of setting a fire in the case of a pyromaniac. It makes little difference between not knowing that one is setting a fire and having the inability to keep from setting that fire. You do not control the person by levying penal sanctions. You should also keep in mind, I would submit, that your present test has a causal element to it. Simply showing that a person is insane does not necessarily give the person to the fence. It's as a result of that particular insanity this particular act occurred. Without the causal relationship, there is not a defense, regardless of the fact that the person may be insane. And I have to defer, or not defer, but I have to disagree with people say that any of the bills define insanity. Nowhere in any of the bills do I see the defanity, that insanity means schizophrenia, means whatever. What we're saying is how much of insanity are we going to require before we allow the person to be exculpated. If I can finally return, or finally refer to the specific proposals to full fix your present statute, they all have the following inadequacies as far as we are concerned as the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. They all do away with the volitional element and make liable people that cannot conform. They subject criminal sanctions on people that are unable to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. All of the statutes require that the mental disease or defect be so extreme that it completely eradicates the mental element of the crime, if there is a mental element defined in the crime. This is one of the problems for the psychiatrists previously when they were discussing the issue of McNaughton. They said even in the most severe cases of schizophrenia, the person does not have absolutely no conception, in very few cases at least, no conception of what he or she is doing. You're eradicating, as Dr. Bloom said, you're eradicating the defense in effect when you start requiring complete absence of the cognitive element, especially in conjunction with an absence of volitional as a defense, or you're forcing people to say things that perhaps they wouldn't say in all candor if that were not the test. We submit a quantum leap back into the quagmire that the American Law Institute sought to get us out of. All of the bills remove the defense for misdemeanor property crimes. Kleptomania, that person will go to the county jail. And those that would say, oh, but they that person will be put on probation, very likely so the first time, maybe even the second time. But perforce, by nature of the particular condition, kleptomania being a cyclically kind of thing, not getting any treatment, constantly getting into new problems, they're going to find themselves in the Marion County Jail here in this particular county, and they're not going to get any treatment whatsoever. Not to mention the kind of effect it's going to have impacting the Marion County Jail. And the victimized position this places some very weak kinds of people in terms of the kinds of other criminals that we have, or kinds of criminals, not other criminals, but the kinds of criminals that one finds in these other penal institutions. Specific comments to specific bills, HB 2075. The last version I saw contemplates a not guilty plea for the person that establishes the defense. That, I think, is a mistake because it anticipates the person would simply walk out.